From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Here are perhaps the 10 most complicated words in entrepreneurship.
I don't know why no one thought of this before.
Because there are two big answers to that statement, of course. The first one is, no one thought of it before because you've come up with a genius idea, an earth-shattering concept that is yours, all yours. And the other more likely explanation is, well, people thought of it before, lots of them maybe. And in fact, the ground is possibly littered with the bones of people who thought of it and then tried it and then died. And now nobody's doing it because of that. Now, want to hear those words in action and see which path is taken? Because here's Jean Thompson, the owner and CEO of Seattle Chocolate Company, talking about when she purchased and took over this once struggling company and tried to figure out a pathway for its success.
The chocolate is very much a sort of impulsive buy at grocery when you're going there for other reasons. So I thought, well, what we need to do is we need to expand into grocery. We have the capacity. And, our product is well suited for that. It's bars and these little twist wrap truffles that can be easily merchandised in boxes on grocery shelves. So I went full bore after that. I hired salespeople. You know, we partnered with distributors and brokers and tried to take it nationally. And it actually, I remember my salesperson saying to me, this is the easiest thing I've ever had to sell. It was like falling off a log. It was so easy. And so we're like, yay, I don't know why no one thought of this before kind of thing. And we got really, really big.
There they were. Couldn't miss them. The magic 10 words. I don't know why no one thought of this before. And here's a thing you should know about Jean. She had a marketing background. She understood how to connect a product with a customer. But this was her first time actually running a business.
I'd never even been in a manufacturing facility before. I'd never looked at a P&L or, you know, a balance sheet or any kind of financial metrics for business. I just never had to do that.
So she was running on instinct here. And when those initial results came in, she felt a rush. Like, great, instinct paying off. Why had no one thought of this before? Because no one was me. That's why. It's tempting to think that way, I know. Who hasn't fallen for it before? Who hasn't flattered themselves into believing that they see the thing nobody else does? Anyway, let's cut to the next part of the story.
And so we ended up losing a lot of money.
Jean's business grew fast and it fell fast. And to save it, she'd have to change a lot. She had to shrink the business, lay off a lot of people, and most critically, step back and understand the mechanics of her industry in a way she hadn't before. She had to understand why people had thought of something before and why it didn't work and what she could do with all that knowledge. And she's done that now. The Seattle Chocolate Company ships about 1 million pounds of chocolate a year and has 70 employees. So, how did she get there? That's the question. And we will understand the answer right after this break. If you've ever sent an email to customers, then you know this is not as simple as like sending an email. It's not sending an email. You need the right email marketing platform, one that's actually designed with your type of organization in mind. That's what Emma is. It puts its customers first, offering powerful email marketing with a personal touch. With Emma, you'll have everything you need to connect your data, build your audience, and do your most successful marketing ever. And how do they do it? With their easy-to-use platform, which makes advanced functionality accessible to everyone on your team, no technical skills required. You can even connect Emma with the services you count on to run your business, like Salesforce and Google Analytics. Not to mention, Emma's award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more. So, put the power of email experts behind your marketing. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com.
And now our second sponsor.
I want to tell you about an amazing event from our sponsor. Listen, do you want to learn how to go from good to great to unstoppable? Friday, September 28th through Sunday, the 30th, invest in yourself and buy a ticket for Relentless MV, a one-of-a-kind exclusive event at Lambert's Cove Inn on Martha's Vineyard, where world-class motivators will help you gain the mental edge to push yourself to the next level and maximize your potential. World-renowned trainer Tim Grover, retired Navy SEAL David Goggins, tech entrepreneur and fear guru Patrick Sweeney, and an elite lineup of performance experts will share how they've gained the mental edge that's taken them to the next level. They also have a very special guest, Red Sox great and Hall of Fame pitcher Pedro Martinez. It's a great event to learn, become inspired, and to network with the other A player attendees. Both weekend and day passes are available, and as a listener of this podcast, you get a special deal. Use the promo code SOLVERS to receive $500 off. Visit RelentlessMV, that's Relentless, the letters M and V.com for more information. By now, there are limited tickets available. All right, on with the show. All right, we're back. So first, how did Jean get into the chocolate business to begin with? It's a pretty roundabout route.
So I started my career at Microsoft, and not Microsoft, but at other high-tech companies, ended up at Microsoft. And then in 1991 to 2001, I was an at-home mom with two kids.
But she was also an investor in this local business called the Seattle Chocolate Company. It turned out to be a pretty lousy investment, actually. For its first decade, the company struggled. It had invested heavily in equipment, which left it with a lot of debt. And then in 2001, an earthquake hit Seattle, and the Seattle Chocolate Company's manufacturing facility was the only building to be damaged. It was condemned. And that would have been it for this company unless someone was willing to step up and put a lot of money quickly into saving the facility and getting the chocolate out again. And in this, Jean saw opportunity. Her family became the majority owner, and then she joined as operator in 2002. Then she started to think, well, in a world full of chocolate companies, what's the thing that can make Seattle chocolate distinct?
I looked at the chocolate industry really more from a consumer standpoint. And I realized, gosh, nobody's really marketing to women. I feel like we've got a tremendous amount of potential. I also thought about how women shop. I don't think very many of us take time out of our day to go to a chocolate shop.
This is what leads her to the decision you heard at the start of the show. Hire a bunch of salespeople, have them target grocery stores, and then sell, sell, sell. And sell they did. Major grocery chains happily picked them up. And then she decided to pursue a second line of business, private label. In 2003, almost right off the bat, she landed a huge contract to produce a chocolate under the brand name Frango. Now, I've spent very little time in the Northwest, so wasn't familiar with Frango, but apparently it's a big deal out there. Very beloved, a traditional part of people's holidays, but it's a complicated brand because while people love the name, the ownership itself has actually been pretty unstable. Frango used to be made by a local department store, and then it got bought by another store, and then ended up with Macy's, and now Garrett. And anyway, the point is that the brand is like a hot potato, but Seattle Chocolate is the company contracted to actually make the product now.
Then I thought, oh, this is nice. Private label really keeps the machines going. I should do that.
So Jean starts looking into other private label businesses and lands Target's private label, which at the time was called Choxy. Huge. Again, you might be thinking, just as she was, why had nobody thought of this before? She was just seeing the pathways. Nobody else was. And also, this is exactly what she thought she needed to do in order to run a successful business.
So this was all brand new to me. And so what I thought, because I would see, 100 fastest growing companies and all these metrics that would be in magazines, I thought, oh, that's how you measure success. You must grow very fast. Otherwise, you are not successful. And so I thought, well, wow, look at me. I'm so successful. And then I realized, but I'm losing money, losing way more money than I ever did before growing it that quickly.
And here we reach our turning point. You know, what Jean says here is totally true. And I'll admit, I am part of the problem. Entrepreneur Magazine, like other business magazines, absolutely prints success stories of companies touting huge percentages of growth. This company is growing 200%, 400%, whatever. And the expectation there, but, the way that I think of it as a journalist, but it may not be the reality, I admit, is that the growth is properly managed, that the company has ensured that when their sales grows or staff grows or revenue grows or whatever, that the company's health is growing as a whole, that the growth is good. But the truth is, of course, that not all growth is good and not all growing companies are healthy. A company absolutely can grow too fast, and Gene was about to find that out on multiple fronts. So, first, let's talk about all those grocery stores she was getting Seattle Chocolate into. When her sales team was saying that it was easy to sell those things, what they were really saying was that it was easy to place them, easy to get them into stores. But negotiating that placement is a whole other thing, and getting consumers to buy is a whole other thing on top of a whole other thing. Now, will some buy? Yes, sure. If you're selling in 10 stores and you want to just increase revenue, go ahead and put your product in 100 stores or 1,000 stores. It's a numbers game. Your sales will go up and your revenue will go up, but that doesn't mean your business is healthy.
Big revenue growth is very forgiving, so it pays for a lot of mistakes and kind of disguises a lot of errors. But then it was probably a year later, so it took a long time for the loss to take place. These big grocery chains that we were placing our product in, and our brand was so young and nobody knew about it in other regions of the country, so it basically wasn't getting pulled off the shelf. So what would happen is these big companies would take what they call slotting fees, and the slotting fees are basically rent for shelf space for a certain amount of time, a year. And if you don't reach certain metrics or objectives for the number of pieces that sell per day, per week, which they don't share with you, by the way, you then don't meet, and then they drop you. But in the meantime, they've collected the tens of thousands of dollars of rent on that space, and then, of course, they get to do it again with a new vendor. So I was playing into this sort of system that people who are more experienced in this industry of having to sell to grocery, food, drug, or mass, they learn and they avoid. I fell right into it and lost a ton of money that would get charged back later. Oh, now here, you need to pay for the fact that your product didn't sell and we need to mark it down and we're going to hit you with that again.
Ah, so yes, others in her situation had thought of placing into grocery stores before. And then they learned this, and that's why they weren't doing it. And sure, well-selling brands will deal with all this slotting fee stuff, but they have marketing budgets and brand awareness and are also reaching consumers who are primed for their product. Now, this is all happening. This story with Gene is 13 years ago. And, you know, mainstream stores at that time weren't selling a lot of specialty chocolate. And Seattle Chocolate was more expensive than Hershey's. So people were confused. They weren't interested often. Moving product in those places was hard. And on the private label side, Gene soon also discovered why she didn't have as much competition for those bids as she'd expected. Take, for example, what happened with Target's private label chocolate.
That ended up growing really, really quickly and quickly becoming like a $4 million piece of business. And then they just discontinued it. So I realized that this whole private label direction, I had no control over my fate.
And just to drive the point home, here's another horror story from the trenches of private label chocolate.
Where it's something new that they're trying and upper management's behind for a few years and then they change their mind. We did it for Kroger for a while and that was a total disaster. They made us pay for all of the research and, you know, to determine if it's successful, will be successful. And we had to pay for all the designs. We had to pay for everything for Kroger, the largest grocery company in the world. It's a real good deal for Kroger, and they insist everybody has to do it. And we're like, okay, well, let's do it because it's worked out well for Choxi and for Frango. And then they didn't even let it last 6 months, and they discontinued it. So I never even got a holiday season out of it.
So, all right, Jean clearly needed to make some significant changes. Her grocery store gambit was losing a ton of money, and her private label business was jerking her company back and forth, injecting it with millions of dollars worth of sudden business, only to see that business abruptly disappear. The solution with private label was pretty simple. Stop it. Stop doing it. She did keep the Frango contract because that was good and steady, and the brand has a legacy in the region and hopefully isn't going anywhere. But she stopped pursuing other private label. It wasn't worth the unpredictability. But retail was trickier. She needed to get out into stores. And in pulling back on many of them, she actually had shrunk her overall sales from $13 million to $7 million. So to be clear, that is consciously deciding to shrink the company and shrink sales. No more just thinking about growth is good no matter how it comes. Clearly, that was not $13 million in healthy sales. It was time to come down. So she's got to get her product in front of consumers somehow, and if not in these stores, then what? And this is when Jean realized she had a valuable tool that she hadn't relied upon yet. She had come from a marketing background. I mentioned it at the beginning of the show. She understood how to get products to consumers.
Where it's like, hold on a second, where is our consumer shopping? Which products should we place there? That kind of thing. It's really good sales. but marketing and sales are two sides of the same coin. So I say that, you know, just think about where's your consumer, what's their household income, how much are they prepared to spend on a bar, when do they buy bars, and do they want seasonal bars? And all of that is an integral part of making a good sale.
When Jean had shrunk the company, she had to lay off a number of staffers. And now she started rebuilding with salespeople who she felt were better focused on making the right kind of sales, rather than just focusing on revenue numbers overall. They needed to find the stores where their customer shopped and where the retail deals for them were more favorable. And this wasn't a matter of mass blasting her chocolate over the country. This was a matter of targeting. And this is a really interesting moment because it's not like these thoughts were revelations to Jean. She'd worked at Microsoft in the boom days. She understood marketing and sales. But when she first started building Seattle Chocolate, she wasn't applying those lessons to her new business. And so I asked her, why not? Why does she think she'd overlooked her own professional training?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I didn't know enough about the market of who's shopping where. I didn't do my homework. I didn't try to understand. I just thought bigger was better, and people buy chocolate bars, right? Chocolate sold at all these retailers. What I didn't think through was I didn't know enough about what their metrics were internally to determine if you were going to be successful, and I didn't know the repercussions of, wow, they're just going to drop me. So I didn't realize the stakes were quite as high as they were. I went in a little blind, a little naive. And I'd actually characterize it as, you know, sort of that entrepreneurial, undying optimism kind of bit me there. And then, you know, I knew that my bars would be appealing to a lot of people, but what I wasn't thinking was the price point maybe was a bit of a deterrent or just a lack of brand recognition. So, yeah, I just didn't think about it like a marketer. I thought about it like a business person. Of course, the two should be the same, and in my case are the same, and yet I didn't do that.
From there, Jean's task was clear. She had to build this company slowly, steadily, and strategically. And eventually, the company turned a profit and began looking like the healthy company she'd always wanted it to be. Which isn't to say that she can just go off eating chocolate into the sunset, of course. The business will always face new obstacles, as it does even today. But the important thing is, she learned from trying to grow her business the wrong way. And now, she's equipped to do it right.
I mean, I'll never forget that lesson, and I'm going to be careful about where my growth comes from. But the ultimate challenge for me still remains, how do I grow? Because if you don't grow, you know, so recently we sort of stagnated again. I'm like, okay, what's happening, right? Well, let's look. And what I decided it was that the brand was getting stale, and it just was, you know, people want new and they have an appetite for new like they've never had before and, you know, really short attention span and all of that as consumers. So I better do something. So we did this big brand refresh just this year, like 2 months ago. And now it's like, okay, now I got to go back out and try to find distribution points where that's going to work really well. So staying relevant, right? So in order to grow, you have to be, you know, we've always been sort of great packaging and a very creative kind of innovative sort of chocolate company. But that's hard to do. You got to stay current all the time. So that's my current challenge, right? Because if you don't continue to grow, you're going to die.
One last time, let's go back to that question from the beginning. Why has no one thought of this before? Okay, to know the answer to that, you have to be a student of your own business. Some entrepreneurs surround themselves with industry insiders who know where all the trapdoors are. Others may not have those people available or have to react too quickly to seek them out. And so they go down the path themselves, finding out where those trapdoors are along the way. Either way, I think it's an endorsement for really understanding the mechanics of your industry. You can try to redefine it, you can blaze your own path, but the more you know or learn or are willing to absorb and react to and process and understand, the more you'll know what paths are worth taking and which ones are empty for a reason. Jean clearly learned the lessons herself. She saw the mistakes firsthand. She felt them. But because she was able to make hard decisions along the way, because she was able to react quickly and smartly, she learned and she survived. And now the world has more chocolate. It's a happy ending. And that's our episode. But wait, before you go, please hear me out on a few ways you can stay in touch with the show and contact me directly. First of all, if you like the show, it would be amazing if you subscribe to it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Problem Solvers. That way, you'll never miss an episode. We come out every Monday morning. Also, I love hearing from listeners. You can go to jasonpfeiffer.com. That's J-A-S-O-N, F as in Frank, E-I, F as in Frank, E-R.com, where you'll find my email address, social media handles, and also you can sign up for my monthly newsletter, The Pfeiffer Five, which is 5 monthly insights and bursts of inspiration for entrepreneurs. It's basically a collection of the ideas that excited me the most that month. So please go check it out. And that's again, jasonpfeiffer.com. And if you want to drop me a line directly, please let me know about the problems you've solved, and I might have you read the letter in a future episode of the show. We can all learn from each other, and that also means you. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media, and this episode was edited by Conrad Martin. We are also online at entrepreneur.com. Again, I'm Jason Pfeiffer. Thanks for listening, and now go solve some problems.